Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, Leila Lateef.
Hi.
Hello. So this week we are talking to Baz Luhrmann about the Oscar chances of Elvis. Plus we're reviewing controversial Monroe study Blonde, starry Vietnam dramedy The Greatest Beer Run Ever, Cockle Warmer Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, Peter Strickland's latest mind melder Flux Gourmet, and the long-awaited sequel Hocus Pocus 2. But before we get onto that, what have you guys been watching? Leila?
I was a bit ill last week, so I spent a lot of time in bed, so I've watched an insane amount of stuff recently. But I got asked to do a Blu-ray essay for a re-release of Alec Baldwin's 1990 film, Miami Blue. And so I basically spent a week watching Alec Baldwin films. I am now, mastermind subject is Alec Baldwin. I have seen absolutely almost everything that he's done at this point. I watched every Trump impersonation, so much 30 Rock, so much Hunt for Red October, Beetlejuice, just, you know.
What's his number one in your opinion?
Into him. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes.
I got to say, I know it's just one scene, but I think that is like one of the greatest bits of acting that he ever did. Almost like the rest of the film falls apart a bit without it, which is strange because it's not in the play. David Mamet wrote it for Alec Baldwin just to make the play long enough to kind of justify in a film. And it's like, it's by far the highlight of the whole thing.
Agreed. Yeah. Indeed. Jamie, what have you been watching? Have you been lying on your back with a Lucozade or a warm lemon drink?
I haven't. No, I was ill a couple of weeks ago, but I'm now, touch wood, fully recovered. I've been watching. I'm finally catching up on the final season of Better Call Saul because I just put it off and put it off because I wanted to binge it. So I didn't watch it until it was all up. And then when it was all up, I had loads of work to do and there was loads of other TV and films and blah, 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 and various other reasons. So I finally got to it a couple of days ago. And I'm halfway through that, binging it, absolutely adore it, like I have all the other seasons, just one of the greatest TV shows, right up there with Breaking Bad for me, if not maybe even surpass Breaking Bad, I'd go that far. So I've been watching that, and then I've also had a bit of a Goddard binge. He shuffled off the Mortal Coil, so I've gone back and watched a few Goddards I haven't seen for a few years, his kind of early stuff, which I really like. Obviously kind of Breathless, Le Mepris, Alphaville, Weekend, all that kind of 60s stuff. And then I've also had a first watch of a few of his films, later films in the 70s and stuff that I hadn't seen before. And I'm struggling with them. After the 60s, I really find him a bit kind of, I don't know, hectoring in his politics. And yeah, it all kind of falls apart for me. I watched Sympathy for the Devil for the first time, his Rolling Stones documentary, which, given that I really don't like the Rolling Stones, and given that...
Get out.
I'm sorry. I know.
None of it. Is it the music or is it them as people?
Mainly the music, to be honest. Okay. For me, I know I'm on my own on this, but most...
And it's in so many film soundtracks.
I know. But the thing is, I absolutely adore Martin Scorsese, and Scorsese has him in loads of films, and obviously did the documentary on them as well. But I just don't really get it. So I didn't really get on with Sympathy for the Devil, which again is also really kind of hectoring in its politics, and really, I just didn't like it. But that's what I've been doing, Goddard and Better Call Saul.
Good. Lovely. I haven't been watching much talk because we're on deadline, but I have been having a chat with... Mr. Baz Luhrmann. So that's what I've been doing today. In fact, I've literally rushed from him to you. And we were talking in our chat about Oscar chances. So we probably should have a little talk about that because it's getting to that time of year. What are we thinking right now, Jamie?
You're probably better placed than I am on this, Jane, because both you and Leila obviously went to the Venice Film Festival, where quite a few of the kind of Oscar contenders dropped, and then TIFF afterwards, Toronto, obviously, as well. So for me, I'm kind of, all the films I'm hearing about that are kind of circling, I haven't seen yet. So,
oh, Jamie.
Not yet. I'm desperate to see them. Like, I'm desperate to see the new Martin McDonagh, which I know you absolutely adore. And everyone is playing, will be up for awards. So, yeah.
That was the only thing that our Venice Critics WhatsApp group, which was about 25 people, nobody didn't like.
It was the only one that we could agree on.
Yes. So So that obviously, but other than that, like I haven't seen Brendan Fraser in The Whale yet, so I can't talk about his best actor chances. I know that you, Jane, think that Austin Butler and Elvis has a really good chance,
Well, Jamie and I
but
have a wager on this, don't
we
we?
do £10. We do.
10 whole pounds, because I say he will get it, and you say he'll get the nom, but he won't get it.
I know the Academy have changed a lot in the last few years. They've changed their makeup and gone more diverse and younger, and it's harder to predict maybe now, but I just think traditionally they don't go for young actors who are sort of making star-making breakthroughs. And even though it's a biopic and it's Elvis and he's very famous and they like that, I just don't think they'll give him the actual gong. I think he'll get a nomination and they think that's enough for now. And in another 10 years with a big CV behind him, maybe he'll get one, but not now.
But there's a lot
Yeah.
more younger people voting now who might
Yeah.
appreciate the fact that this 30-year-old, 31 is he now, year old man, put in this immense amount of work to do this role, and that it speaks for itself on the screen. I don't know. What do you think, Leila?
I think that there's such a problem when it comes to like awards of like that they just decide that it's someone's time rather than it going on like the merit of the performance. So I can just see someone like I think it's probably going to be a Brendan Fraser, but who knows, because so much of it's about how much money they put in behind the campaign. But yeah, if I was going to do like with the awards things when they do a should win, will win,
Yes.
I think Austin Butler really should win. I think it's probably going to be Brendan Fraser.
I might be losing that tenner. Shall we see what Baz Luhrmann thinks about this when I asked him? I sat down with him earlier today to celebrate the home entertainment release of his glittering biopic, and here's what he had to say.
I wish to promote you, Mr. Presley.
One through a party and return to jail.
Are you ready to fly?
I'm ready. Ready to fly.
Tomorrow, all of America will be talking about Elvis Presley.
I can't move, I can't sing.
It's been such a huge thing for cinemas and cinema going. It's
Yeah.
this one of the saviors of cinema, and as much as people have really embraced it, gone back to it numerous times, that must be really gratifying for you, wasn't it?
What you said is what is one of the most gratifying things is the cross-generational. I was walking in New York literally 48 hours ago, and as I was walking along, I had these quite groovy shoes on. This young guy goes, "Hey man, love your shoes." And then he looks up, he goes, "Oh, you're that, Elvis." He went, "You directed?" "Yes." He said, I took my grandmother, he was only 25 or something. I took my sister and my mother. We've all seen it 3 times. And, can I get a selfie? Sure, 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 all that. But what is really true is that when I set about doing this, you got to remember, I came from a very small country town and we had the gas station farm, but at one point we had the small picture theatre. When people came to the theatre in a country town like that, you were taking their lives in your hands in a sort of way. They're weak in your hands at the very least, And so the meaning of strangers coming together in a dark room and actually communing and looking up at a screen and laughing and being moved by it is so inherent in everything I do. So that's why I told Warners I wouldn't do it unless we pushed the window until streaming. And my singular focus was both in making the film, which is very theatrical, and certainly getting out there and communicating the film, was to get audiences back into the theatre that weren't coming. That's really was my mission. And so, long answer to your very concise question, which is, yeah, it feels good. I never believed the naysayers who said, older people will not come back to the theatre, or that theatre's dead. I never believed that. I mean, when television was invented in the 50s, people said the same thing, but the movies just got bigger. I think some people are claiming this is a master plan, but it wasn't. There was a bit of a sidekick thing here that happened that was really a good education, and it's good news for everyone. Because the theatrical was so big and it was so cross-generational, what I didn't say no to was the VOD, which is the video on demand where you pay to download it. I just didn't think of it, to be honest. And that window of VOD was so long. So it went VOD after a certain amount of time, but it was so long that it like double indexed, like they did so much more video on demand. And then when it went to streaming, you could see that actually the theatrical life of it spoke to its popularity on streaming. So all the different portals succeeded because We really invested in making it a theatrical cinematic experience first. So do you know what I mean? It's had a really nice knock-on effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously the critical response has been really good and people are already talking about awards. Mm-hmm. And it's probably time, isn't it? Isn't it time for you to get a little shiny gold bald man?
I've given up. My wife has four of them and she comes down in the morning, she slams them on the table. She says I'm a bit of a slacker, you know. No, I'm just kidding, but I'd be absolutely thrilled. I grew up in a small country town watching the Oscars. I've been to the Oscars. I've done the numbers on the shows. But I also, in my mind, kind of signed off because I work in, I tell stories in a very particular way and I live sort of outside the box. I'm also sensible enough to acknowledge, you know, an Orson Welles or a Kubrick or people who do things in a very particular style don't easily sit inside the box. Having said that, the film being nominated is really important because I think it puts enormous light on the actual movie itself. Like, audiences love The Race, and so they go, oh, Elvis is in there. Okay, that, for those that haven't seen it or have seen it, you know, yeah, either there's a film that I like and it's in, so there the energy is there, or you haven't seen it, you're still in the conversation. So that's important. I do think that you can't look at what Austin Butler achieved. I mean, Tom for sure too. But what Austin actually achieved, I just don't think you can look at that to be as Elvis for 2 years, day and night, and the level of just work he did and not consider him to at least be on that list. I think that would be, I think he deserves that. As well as, you know, Mandy, CM, I mean, why shouldn't she have another couple? All the team really gave their all. And we did it during a pandemic, and we actually, after Tom got the COVID, I mean, the movie nearly went away. And I have to take my hat off to Tom to recover from COVID and bravely come all the way back to Australia, go through quarantine and lead the charge on making the movie, you know.
Yeah. One of the things that the fans are really keen on that you've sort of spoken about is the four-hour cut. And there's obviously that there's so much that you actually threw away. Is it something that we can expect? And is that another way to make the life of this movie longer?
Let me say one thing, because something's about to happen where I know everyone's going to talk about this thing that's going to happen and it's going to relate to Elvis. One, it's a four-hour director's assembly. That's just like every single bit I shot and strung out, like in long, long, long scenes, you know, like it wasn't just like hundreds of other scenes. Having said that, and it won't be this year and it won't be next year, but I am about to do on Hulu a show called Faraway Downs, which is Australia reimagined with no new footage, with all the footage I did shoot, but new music I did with a lot of young Indigenous performers and singers and graphics and things like that. And there's definitely some big plot changes and evolutions that I kind of thought, oh, what would it be like going that way? Now, whether I spoil people who like Australia or not, Australia will exist. It's a living film. You know, it has its own life. Faraway Downs is a bit like Debussy doing variations on Sati, you know what I mean? Like, it's a variation on the same work. I really can't underline enough how it's not going to happen, you know, next year. One thing I will tell you is the performance sequences that Austin did are very much longer than are in the movie. And he's done some that aren't in the movie. And even just releasing it with those maybe extended, you know, would be something worth considering. Could I see a day where a kind of elaborate, extended variation on the movie comes for a streaming, just like Faraway Downs? Yes, I could imagine that, because I know one thing, is that the kind of style of the assembly of a longer version like that would beg a different kind of way of doing it. You know, you'd go a slightly different way. And I'm all right with that. I'm open to, like, doing variations on, not like going, like, there's the movie, throw everything in it, because it actually changes the nature and the DNA of that movie. But the idea of, like, using material to do a kind of variation on the work, like something different. I said jokingly, be careful what you say jokingly. Oh, you know, and by the way, I'm too tired, you know. And, of course, the clickbait is, you know, I'm too tired to bother doing it. It isn't that at all. It takes a lot of money. If I added an extra 10 minutes, 15 minutes, an extra 30 minutes, it's very expensive to do that. It's not just sitting there finished, you know.
Right, so that's Baz hoping he gets an Oscar to bring down to the breakfast table. Do we think he'll get a nomination?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's kind of long overdue, isn't it? I think Baz Luhrmann's kind of, you know, that whole kind of maximalism and just like, you know, actually trying to make stuff really fun and entertaining gets like overlooked in terms of like, but I think the culture's kind of caught up to him. And I think that's why the box office for Elvis has been so good. And that's why, you know, the reviews have, for the most part, been excellent.
And he's, if you're talking about people who are due, he's, you know, Moulin Rouge, Romeo and Juliet, let's skip over Gatsby, but Strictly Ballroom. He's got like a number of things that you could say he's deserving of it over a sort of period of years.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I think he'd just scrape in. I don't think he'd win it. But the fact that he has been toiling away for 20, 25 years and made some real beloved pictures, and the fact that this has great box office, which always helps, they like a success. I think all of those stars are aligned that he would get the kind of fourth or fifth director nomination.
I know that you guys like Coda more than me, but it does seem like mad that we're saying that like Elvis couldn't win an award that Coda won. In terms of like a feat of filmmaking.
But here's the thing, I'd completely forgotten about the existence of Coda until you just mentioned it. I did love that, yeah. And I realised I haven't thought about it once since, so that's kind of interesting.
I enjoyed Coda, but it wasn't in my top kind of 40, 50 films of last year. I liked it more than Layla, but, you know, how that actually won Best Picture, and like Jane, I've completely forgotten about it, so it's really bizarre, that one.
Go Elvis, I say. Elvis is available in cinemas still. Baz wants to let you know. And on download and on disc now. And it's number one download, apparently, today. And for more on Baz, do look out for Total Film's Last Picture Show tomorrow as Mr. Luhrmann picks the four films he'd programme on his last night at the cinema ever. OK, so from one icon in Elvis to another. Let's get controversial. It's this.
Marilyn Monroe. I can't face doing another scene with Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn doesn't exist. When I come out of my dressing room, I'm Normie Jean. I'm still hurt when the camera's rolling.
This is Blonde. Layla, for people who have been under a rock for the past few weeks and not heard about this controversial film, fill us in.
So this is based on a Joyce Carol Oates novel, which came out about 20 years ago, which is a fiction inspired by the life of Marilyn Monroe, which in the book, it goes all the way from, I think, when she's a toddler up until her death. And this film follows a similar path, but we do skip over a lot of that kind of teenage growing up ingenue. We start kind of with the original trauma of being Marilyn Monroe as a child, that she had a very mentally ill mother. She never got to meet her father. Then we kind of skip forward to her transitioning from being a model to making it in Hollywood. And I think one of the most amazing things about the life of Marilyn Monroe and this film is that that's actually only 11 years from her first role to her death is, you know, everything, every image that you've seen of her, all of her films, all of her roles, it's just a little over a decade. The film is basically mostly looking at that decade, looking at kind of the many things that, terrible things that happened to her, the many disappointments and romances that went wrong, and the way that she was abused by the network, and the way that she was misunderstood and underestimated, and all of these things. It's not a traditional biopic at all, though. It's very fantastical. It's often like really surreal. But it's also, you know, anything that isn't a one-to-one map is going to cut. You've got to make choices what you cut and what you include. And like Andrew Dominik, to, you know, has really upset a lot of people because he's kind of framing this a bit like Joyce Carol Oates did, as like a mystery as to what are the things that led to Marilyn Monroe dying by suicide. That is the chain that we're following of just like, how can someone who had everything that Marilyn Monroe did, and at several points that, you know, this one point she's being dressed by people and they say like, you're so lucky, you have everything, you know, she's so successful, she's so rich, she's so beautiful, and like, how could that have led to such a tragic end? So that's like really the journey that this film is following.
And why has it upset people?
A lot of reasons. I think a lot of people feel that it's unfair to frame Marilyn's accomplishments in such a sad way. A lot of people are not happy with all the depictions of sexual assault in the film. There's a lot of nudity. It's like, it's probably the most hardcore Netflix film that they probably ever put out there. But yeah, also that they feel that like maybe Andrew Dominik as a filmmaker doesn't admire her enough and kind of talk to all of the wonderful things that she did do and all the accomplishments and just kind of focuses on like the sadness and her lack of agency. Personally, that didn't bother me. I'd read the book beforehand. I knew what I was getting into. And like, I think as much as like someone like Marilyn Monroe needs to be celebrated for all of the wonderful things that she does, it's also kind of doing her a disservice to not acknowledge the absolutely hideous stuff that happened to her. I was kind of left with like, yeah, maybe if I am going to take joy from Gentleman Called Blonde or Some Like It Hot or something, I should kind of have a bit of a look in the mirror about like, well, you know, you're sort of benefiting from like the absolutely hideous stuff that somebody had to go through. So yeah, I mean, it's an upsetting film. It's a dark film, but it worked for me.
Jamie, did it work for you?
Yes, on the whole, I liked it. What Layla's just said about the reasons people don't like it, I can kind of see that, but only to a point. Like the lack of agency, for example, a lot of people have talked about. For me, that's kind of the point of the film, that it showed her in a better light in some ways than I expected, that sometimes she's portrayed or thought about as this really kind of dumb blonde. And I don't think it did that at all. I think it showed that she was smart. She had really good acting instincts. She really brought things to the table. And the lack of agency was because she was treated so bloody horribly by Hollywood, by the men in Hollywood, by the producers, by husbands. And I think, you know, that was kind of the point of it in a way. So I think that's a little bit unfair. But having said that, it is a bit one note, but it is very, very miserable. You know, you get the odd glimmer of happiness when she first gets with Arthur Miller, things like that. But on the whole, you know, she really, really has a bad time of it. It focuses from kind of 1952, mainly, to her death in 1962. And stuff like When Gentlemen Prefer Blondes comes up, that everyone thinks of as this kind of happy film and people go to it for a little bit of escapism. You kind of see the stuff that happened before that and the fact that, you know, she was pregnant, very happily so, pretty much forced into an abortion by the studio, by the people around her who just treated her as a kind of cash cow and a meat puppet. So yeah, it's pretty bleak, but I think the performance by Ana de Armas is great, absolutely superb. I think the fact that Andrew Dominik kind of really goes for it, he throws everything at it, which again I think has upset some people, but the techniques, it's kind of got it really does go for it, doesn't hold back. She talks to the fetuses inside her, like unborn babies. You kind of have things like that. You have shots, camera shots from like in her uterus looking out. It kind of really goes, I can see again why people have gone, this is not what I want, you know. But I think it's a bold, brave, three-hour film. And on the whole, I did like it. I liked it quite a lot.
I knew you would. I texted you beforehand and you were like, I don't think I'm going to like it. I was like, Jamie, you're going to, really.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm a massive fan of Monroe. I have been since I was a little girl, you know, idolised her. Had the poster, you know, had the VHS tapes that I watched repeatedly to watch her sort of shimmer like this beautiful goddess across the screen. I know a lot about her. I've read the book. I've read all of the biographies and everything. I know all of the harshness of this. So for me, it didn't feel like it's saying anything outrageously new. It's purely, I think, framing it more as a, this is what happened to women. It's not just Marilyn Monroe. This is what happened to women in Hollywood at this time. And this is what it took to be a star. And that's a horrible age-old story. And also the thing I think that's really interesting about this is the complicity of audience in it. By watching it, we participate in this devouring of a person. And that's clearly shown in this film that, you know, there's these moments when she's going through a crowd and they're baying for her and their faces distort and they're absolutely grotesque. And that's, it's fearful, it's horrible, it's aggressive, it's all those things. And that's how she felt moving through her so-called fans. But also that we're part of this machine ourselves. We see it with, you know, anyone from Caroline Flack to, you know, Britney Spears or anyone who we enjoy watching and we enjoy to see them in any kind of medium. And whilst we demand it, that they will be abused and exploited to deliver it. And so for me, I think it said a lot about us as viewers that we should actually have a think about how we consume our celebrities and our film stars. And I found that part of it really, really interesting. And the fact that it was Monroe was obviously a huge part of it, but that she really was a kind of symbol of any woman in the spotlight that we tear down, you know, even a Meghan Markle, you know, like it doesn't matter who it is, that this experience is very specific to women in the media. We do it to men as well, but to a lesser extent. And yeah, I just thought, even with the whole drama of, you know, Don't Worry Darling swirling around with Olivia Wilde and the way that she was treated about the rumours that were going on about that, which were very different to the way a man would be questioned about it, I think Blonde even speaks to that. So for me, I found it a really modern, really interesting, provocative, interesting film. And I also loved what you're saying, Jamie, like the changing ratio, you know, there's beautiful moments like where she's on a bed having a threesome and the bed turns into a waterfall. And it's just this gorgeous image. You know, that's, you know, sex positive as well in this as well. You know, it's not just about her being abused. She's having a sort of interesting symbiotic relationship with these two men that until that turns abusive is a weird nurturing one. I could bang on about this film all day because I think it's just got so much to talk about. And I think that's what's really good about it, don't you? That people will watch this and then have these discussions with each other about all sorts of different aspects of it.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. But yeah, it does. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, a lot of people who have particular sensitivities that, you know, if you're someone that gets triggered by, you know, depictions of a sexual assault, like, don't go anywhere near this.
No.
But it did seem strange to me that a lot of the criticism I saw was like, oh, it's so brutal, it's so upsetting. And I was just like, what do you think Andrew Dominik was trying to do here?
If it upsets you and you think it's gross, maybe because it was supposed to do that and make you think about what we do to stars. Maybe that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to what you said, Jane, and people like Britney Spears, it really reminded me of Amy Winehouse and the Amy Winehouse doc when I was watching it, which again is that sort of paparazzi constantly there devouring a famous woman. And then all of us, yeah, complicit in it. Kind of, you know, I remember when people used to laugh and joke, you know, about Amy Winehouse, like, oh, gosh, she's trashed again. And it was all some big joke. And it's just not funny at all. But because it's someone famous, a celebrity, everyone thinks they can just sort of rip them apart and feed on them. And, you know, and it's all fair game when, of course, it's not. So there's all of that to it. The thing that really surprised me about this film, which I didn't expect, is to me, it was really like a horror movie. The more it went on.
Yeah.
Especially the last hour where it gets really sort of woozy as she's taking more pills and she's disorientated. And it's that whole thing that we've seen in many, many horror films and, you know, whether it's Repulsion or Mario Bava's Shock or so many others where it's kind of a woman kind of driven insane almost by, you know, just all these things going on around her. And it's so woozy. And it really reminded me of like Laura Palmer as well in Twin Peaks. And I think that must have been intentional even because the music, it's got a fantastic score by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, who always do great work. And the music is actually around this time in the last hour or so. It's very similar to Laura's theme, like Laura Palmer's theme in Twin Peaks. So I think it was intentional. But again, that was, you know, about a kind of inner life and, you know, what you see on the outside and what you think someone's going through or how happy they must be. And then obviously on the inside, it's very, very different. And it just really reminded me of that. And I felt really uncomfortable watching it. And like I said, with the kind of wooziness and the madness and all of that, it just felt like a horror film, like all off kilter, going beyond control until obviously at the end, it's a suicide. You know, I was watching the whole film thinking, I like this and I'm impressed by it, but it's not really emotionally affecting me. And then the last hour, the last half hour particularly, really got to me. And when it finished, I found it really sad, really moving, harrowing. You know, I think it's a good film.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going to talk about someone's legacy, I mean, obviously, someone like Marilyn Monroe isn't going to just be defined by one version. There's so much out there. But I just think it's like part of that legacy has to be what we did to this woman as a society, and not just like, oh, isn't Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend so delightful? You know, she actually kind of that slightly toothless, you know, My Week with Marilyn about like, she was a really talented actress recently. Like, I actually think we need to kind of confront this a bit more head on.
Do you think part of a problem with it, of people not liking it, because I've deliberately kind of avoided the discourse until I saw it, because I didn't want it ruined for me. And I only saw it last night, so I'm not up to date on it. But is part of a problem that it's a kind of fictionalized or semi-fictionalized account, and it's kind of an inner life of Marilyn Monroe. Because I actually watched it with my wife last night, and her big problem with it was there's lots of scenes where it's just her and one other person in a room and stuff like that. And she was going, well, how can they know that happened? Like, they're just making it up. This is bullshit. Like, and she had a real problem with that. It didn't bother me as much at all, because I thought, you know, it's kind of making that leap and it's kind of doing that thing of trying to imagine what led to that suicide at the end. But the film obviously doesn't make that clear. There's nothing at the start saying, you know, this is fictionalized or semi-fictionalized. So people will take it as a straight biopic.
Well, the book does. The book's very clear about that. When you open the book, it says, you know, if you want to read a Monroe biography, these are the ones that you should go and read. This isn't what that is. So the book is. But yeah, the film isn't necessarily clear. Yeah.
I mean, there's a really, really upsetting scene with John F. Kennedy as well, which again, stuff like that, I don't know how much of that is absolutely on record that that happened, or if it's kind of imagined or taken from tales, anecdotes, or kind of, you know, how much is absolute gospel. Like that threesome you mentioned at the start.
She was never in a couple.
That's just a little complete fantasy.
If you know that and take it as an inner life for someone and kind of imagining it, that's not a problem. You know, I think it gets to an emotional truth and it does it really well. But if you don't know that, then maybe it is a bit of a problem.
Yes. And also, you know, the criticism has been that, you know, we've already done this to this woman. Why do we have to take her apart again by a director who apparently doesn't seem to like her very much anyway, and has done some interviews over the past week that haven't necessarily cast him in the best light. So, yeah, there's a lot to discuss and a lot to unpack. But also, you know, just to be completely, you know, surface about this, the skill with which Ana de Armas essays Monroe and the way that she hits that particular pose, so you can see that photo, you can see that Life magazine cover, you know, it's astonishing the way that they, even in scenes where she's on the phone to her agent about something, she's sitting in a chair in the clothes you've seen Monroe, and you realize how much media of her you've ingested through your life, whether you're a fan of hers or not. You just know those pictures so well. So I think from that point of view, that the sort of idea of how famous people and their portrayal is sort of ingrained in our psyche, whether we want it there or not, is really interesting as well, that it sort of lives inside us. We know exactly what she looks like when she's on that grate in her billowing white dress. We know exactly what her smile was like. And Ana de Armas absolutely nails it for me.
Something I really loved about the film as well, which maybe we should touch on, is when they kind of do all the clips as well, like a few famous clips from the movies, like Some Like It Hot. I think they kind of restage it. Am I right in saying that? Mm-hmm. Because they're so spot on.
Like the Niagara one, sure. You can't tell.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
I was never quite sure. I was like, is that a clip from the original movie or is that Ana de Armas recreating it and Andrew Dominic recreating it? Because it is absolutely perfect. And I think maybe there's a few actual clips and a few recreated ones and they kind of blend them, but it's brilliant. It's spot on.
It's unbelievable. I mean, there's this scene kind of more towards the end where she's sort of sitting in front of a mirror. She's getting her makeup done by her beloved makeup artist, and she's sort of begging Marilyn to appear because she kind of thinks of herself as Norma Jean, and Marilyn is kind of almost something that she's created for her career. And you just see this moment where Ana de Armas just seems to be able, in 1 second, switch on and transform entirely into Marilyn Monroe. It's genuinely quite magical, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's the clip that they'll roll for the Oscar noms, I would say. Do we think she's got a chance?
Yeah, I think so. It's such an impressive feat, like, because the tone changes so often. It's, like, often really surreal. She's tasked with so much. Like, I think it'd be a real shame, even if people kind of have their issues with Dominic, to, like, not recognise that performance would be a real shame.
Yeah, I spoke to her the other week for a Q&A about the role. And what I didn't realise was she filmed this in 9 weeks, and she had about a year of practicing the voice and the walk and everything else. And she had wigs on and everything else. But literally that the work was a relatively short period of time. And then she flew directly from blonde to No Time to Die and literally went from wiggling down the street as Marilyn to kicking ass in Cuba. And she said, you know, that if she watches the Bond film now, she can see Marilyn in that performance because it was difficult to shake. But I just think, I mean, let's not talk about Deepwater. Dreadful.
Yeah.
But she's actually a really accomplished actress. And, you know, when you think about, we were just talking about Austin Butler earlier. He had a year and a half to perfect Elvis and sort of lived the role for 2.5, nearly 3 years. She did this in a matter of months. It's absolutely incredible.
She'd definitely be nominated unless the discourse gets in the way and, you know, a lot of people have taken against this film and you never know how it's going to swell. You know, the Oscars are still a long way off. That may all blow over and suddenly everyone decides they like the movie, or it may grow and grow. And if it grows and grows and it kind of stains her and her performance so it doesn't get any nominations, including Best Actress, that would be a real shame.
Indeed.
Okay, thinking Ana de Armas, Viola Davis is probably shooing, Kate Blanchett. Any, these are big Best Actress contenders?
Yeah.
Early to say, I suppose.
Yeah. But for lead actress, yeah. I think that we've more films to see for the other slots. I think we might have Elvis and Marilyn at the Oscars. That's what I'm saying. Which would be my dream.
You just need Bros there now, and then that would really be
if
your
dream. If I could have Bros, Marilyn and Elvis, it's the whole thing. It's the hat trick. Okay, so if you want to take a look at Blonde, do be warned. It does have some scenes that are not suitable for people who might be triggered by trauma. It is out in Netflix now. Okay, do we need a drink after that then? How about a beer?
Hey, get your ass out of bed, you lazy bum. Look at you, sleeping your life away.
Look at these scumbags.
Hey, you're embarrassing yourself and you're embarrassing your family.
Do these protesters not know that our soldiers see that on TV? I'd like to go over to Vietnam, track down all the boys in the neighborhood and give them a beer.
I could do that.
Do what?
Bring him beer.
He's not serious, he's hammered, look at him.
The man's stone sober. That's his fifth beer, maybe, tops.
I'm going to Vietnam, and I'm bringing a beer! Yeah!
So this is the greatest beer run ever. How so, Jamie?
So this is based on a true story, and it's set in 1967, and it's about a guy called Chicky Donahue, who is played by Zac Efron.
Can I just ask, what's his real name? Because, like, who gets called Chicky?
That was his real name.
But it's surely short for something, is it?
I've no idea.
Charlie? Charles?
Chick? I've no idea.
How do you get called Chicky?
Oh, everyone, yeah, apparently
everyone gets
this, his name was John.
It's a nickname.
So now you get from John to Chicky.
Well, this is information I need, but carry on.
I was called Chewbacca at university by a lot of people.
You know, obvious. Name,
but that's, there you go. But anyway, he's Chicky Donahue, and he's a merchant mariner who lives in Inwood in New York, a neighborhood of New York. And when he's not on a boat, he's basically just in his local bar, drinking with his mates, having a good time, living it up. And there starts to be a lot of anti-war sentiment going around the country, the Vietnam War. And it reaches Inwood, New York, and there's quite a few protests. And Chicky's not happy with this at all. He's very patriotic. He believes the boys are out there doing their duty, fighting a good fight for their country. So he decides that he is going to do something for them to show his gratitude and a neighborhood's gratitude. And he says, I will hop on a boat because he's a merchant mariner. I'll go.
Mariner. Why are you saying mariner? That's where boats are kept. It's a mariner.
Oh, sorry. I'm always doing
this. Think about Waterworld.
Okay, a merchant mariner. And he's going to hop off in Vietnam with a sack full of beers, a bag full of beers. And he's got four mates from the neighborhood who are all fighting in different areas of Vietnam. And he's going to take choppers, jeeps, whatever he has to do, track them down and take them all a good old American beer to say the neighborhood's proud of you. Thanks for your duty. We all love you. And so this is what he does. And it sounds absolutely mad. It sounds ridiculous, but it's a true story. And this really happened.
And is it any good?
I enjoyed it and I didn't expect to. I had no idea about this being a true story. And when I first heard about this film being made about a year ago, it's being directed by Peter Farrelly, who obviously part of the Farrelly brothers who made There's Something About Mary, Dumb and Dumber, all of those. And Zac Efron in the starring role. I thought this is going to be like Dumb and Dumber with a Vietnam backdrop, and it's going to be really sort of a or American Pie, and it's going to be a comedy, and it's going to be an adventure story, and it's all going to be a bit dodgy, and why are they making this, and it's not going to work. And it wasn't the film I expected. But yes, it is an adventure, and Zac Efron has got loads of charm and all of that. But the deeper he gets into Vietnam and the more he kind of sees of it, he begins to realise that actually America is being fed lies on the TV, that Lyndon B. Johnson is just talking absolute rubbish. And what are they really fighting for? And it's not like, you know, his father and grandfather going over to Europe to try and defeat the Nazis. You know, this is just absolute madness and it's chaos. And he starts hooking up with a photojournalist played by Russell Crowe, and he kind of sees more and more of the war, and it kind of changes his opinion. And even though it's not by any means a movie like Salvador, you know, Oliver Stone's Salvador,
yeah, no,
it doesn't go that far, and it's, you know, it's a bit more kind of audience friendly than that, but it is a bit more politically aware and a bit sort of tougher than I expected. Because like I said, I thought it was going to be American Pie in Vietnam, and I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. I had a good time with it.
Layla?
Yeah, I came into this book with quite a bit of bias because I really don't like Peter Farrelly. I didn't like Green Book at all. And he was actually on like the final season of, do you remember that Project Greenlight show that
yes.
Matt Damon and Ben Affleck did? And so he's on the final season, and he does not come across well. I think it struggles to settle on a tone. I think it's going for sort of Oscar glory, feel good, you know, being a bit profound, being a bit of a, maybe like a Forrest Gump or something like that. And I don't think it really succeeds in that way. But Zac Efron, I thought, was really, really good in this. And I thought, if anything, what this is going to do is hopefully someone like a Spielberg or a, you know, a Ridley Scott, someone is going to see that actually Zac Efron really needs a meaty role. And he might be kind of in awards contention, you know, in a former year. So it was a stepping stone into like appreciating him as an actor. It's just like, yeah, I'm kind of all for this. But yeah, I mean, didn't do a huge amount for me. Kind of saw a lot of it coming miles away. It was sort of like being in a pub and listening to someone tell like a really wacky story that about something that happened to them that you kind of only half believe, and you reckon that they've kind of, you know, they're sugarcoating their own behavior and their motives in it, which isn't unenjoyable, but like, you know, I'm never going to think about this again after this podcast is over.
Yes, I agree. It's kind of light, isn't it? And it's quite simplistic in the ideas that it's touting, and like we are not unaware of what was going on in Vietnam now. And so when people sort of say things that are straight out of history books and sort of, you know, well, you know, the Viet Cong are, I think you'll find, and, you know, Russell Crowe there sort of over his malt whiskey explaining the political situation, it sort of felt a bit like Vietnam for Dummies. But I do agree with you about the whole Zac Efron thing. I really liked him in The Paperboy, and he didn't really capitalize on that. So I really liked what he was doing in this, because he wasn't playing particularly likable. This guy is, you know, a bit of a meathead who, you know, doesn't question anything and has no motivation and ends up in this ridiculous situation. And I did enjoy the sort of comedy of everyone thinking that because he insisted he wasn't CIA, he absolutely must be CIA. And that sort of ridiculousness, you know, when we've watched American Made and things with Tom Cruise and things, we know that these sort of shady people in different countries, you know, in their slacks, their brown slacks, wandering around are real. So I liked that sort of idea. But yeah, it's sort of, it was very starry for what it was as well. You know, like you've got Bill Murray as the barman that just turns up with a sort of buzz cut and is a bit boozy in the background. As you mentioned, Russell Crowe. It feels like it's a halfway house between two different things and not quite either one thing. But as something you can watch on Apple Plus, perfectly good way to spend a weekend evening, I would say, with a can of beer. I mean, that's a must, I think, because
yeah,
very difficult to watch this with everyone chugging cold beers and not probably want to have one, or an alcohol-free beer.
this is actually, it's Bill Murray's fourth film with Peter Farrelly, I believe, which is kind of crazy, but he obviously, like, he has his little relationship with Wes Anderson and pops up in everything. You know, we mustn't forget he was in Kingpin back in the days. back in the day. And he, again, he plays against type in this. He's kind of behind the bar and he's a colonel, you know, he fought in a war years ago and he's
very patriotic.
Yeah, very patriotic, quite stern. He's not sort of cracking the one-liners or the smirk or anything. I think Forrest Gump, actually, I didn't think of that when I was watching it, but Layla said Forrest Gump. I think that's quite a good comparison, although Forrest Gump feels like a bigger, kind of more expensive production than this. But I think it is kind of going for that kind of feel-good tone, but with serious intent as well. And I don't know, maybe it's just a question of expectations, but I went in with very low expectations and it exceeded them, without a doubt.
So a nice frothy thing to ingest on a weekend, like a good beer. That is the greatest beer run ever, and it hits Apple Plus on Friday. Okay, so before we move on, it's time for alternative line reading. Shall I do this in the style of Marilyn?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're looking quite Marilyn tonight.
Got a red lip on, so here we go. This is obviously a line of somebody we've discussed already in our chat, and it's in the wrong person's accent. I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business.
First of all, your impression was very good, Jane.
I thought it was rubbish, but it's whispery, and that's about it.
I like that. I have no idea who it is. It's not there at all for me.
It's so obvious. It's such, this is like the most, you know, they say, think of the player, not of the line. Oh. And it's like, this would be like Matt Mayton doing a Christopher Nolan film.
Correct.
Obviously.
So think about it, Jamie. The other line I could have said was, I'm real as a donut.
No, it's not happening for me.
What?
It's not happening for me.
The poster right behind her.
Well, I can't see your Elvis. Oh, is it?
Oh, God, this is painful. It's like birthing.
Tell me.
Come on. Tell it's me. A Quentin Tarantino film.
Featuring the person in the Elvis poster.
No.
It's Austin Butler.
Once
Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I had no idea he was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
You didn't?
Plays Tex. He's the guy that gets it in the nuts from the dog and gets a tin of dog food to the face.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, God. It's one of the best moments in the film. He says that line, and then Brad Pitt starts giggling because he's just done a load of acid.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that moment, but it's all about the dog for me. I just adored that dog through that whole film. I had no idea Austin Butler was in that movie. No idea. I didn't know who Austin Butler was until he was Elvis. I've never heard of him. He was just like, oh, this guy's good.
Well, there you go.
It shows that he was in such a great film, how much he transformed to be an Elvis. We should put this in his four-year consideration piece. Jamie loved him in a role and could not recognise him.
There you go.
Tarantino's best film since Jackie Brown. But I
disagree.
Disagree. I'm not having it. It is.
Anyway, this is what Austin Butler sounds like in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I don't know your name, but I remember that hair. And you, I remember your white little face. And you were on a horsey. Yeah. You are...
I'm the devil. And I'm here to do the devil's business.
Moving on, it's time to go dress shopping. It's this.
Paris. Ni se départ, ni se navire.
Excuse me, dear. I'm after a frock, one of them £500 ones.
You have the wrong address.
Please let me escort you out.
No, hang on a minute. I've saved every penny scrubbing floors so I can buy this frock.
Excuse me, but it would be my honour to have you view the collection as my guest.
So this is Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. It's obviously about Mrs. Harris going to Paris. But what else is it about, Layla?
This is based on a book, which then became a play, and it's like now finally a film. And it's about a widow in the 50s in London who discovers that because she kind of hasn't cashed in her late husband's war pension, That she actually got a like really nice big sum of money that she wasn't expecting comes into her life. And so the question becomes, how is she going to, you know, spend this? Or what is she going to do? Because she's kind of working pretty thanklessly for as a cleaner for a lot of really hideous clients. So she decides she's going to do something really like joyful and wonderful. And she's going to go to Paris and she's going to get a dress from Dior, which costs about £500, which I imagine in 1957 money is something like, I don't know, thousands.
Silly money. Silly money.
But yeah, she's going to go. She's going to get a proper haute couture dress from Dior, made for her, customized to her. She's going to scrape some happiness out of like this terrible tragedy that happened to her and like the general kind of misery in her life. So it's lovely. It's Leslie Manville as the titular Mrs. Harris. She goes and she encounters many numbers of French snobs and fashionistas, kind of led by Isabelle Huppert. There's a lot of twists and turns. There's a surprising amount of pro-trade union stuff, which I wasn't expecting coming into this. But yeah, it's a really lovely little film about kind of like, I think, the true joy of clothes and also kind of the joy of treating yourself.
Indeed. This is really a total Cinderella story. It's not about getting the prince. It's about getting the dress or the whatever it is that you really fancy. But also the dress obviously represents a great deal more. It's not just about an item. It's about letting go of something in as much as the fact that she, you know, she's been pining for this husband to come back from the war and he clearly isn't going to now. So it's this sort of very sweet, lovely, sugary film filled with, you know, pictures of the Eiffel Tower and beautiful sort of beret wearing French girls who are just delightful and lovely sort of French gentlemen who will escort her around the showroom and flowers and beautiful French dinners and French streets and, you know, just gorgeous. But at the same time, it is sort of about matters of the heart, which I think you can read into it whatever you want, really.
Yeah, I think for me, I think the thing that's lovely is that it's fundamentally like purchasing this dress makes Mrs. Harris feel like quite powerful all of again. Like she's been so abused by, she's got a few people that she works for, one in particular played by Anna Chancellor, who's kind of probably best known for being Duckface in Four Weddings. And she's just kind of like so monstrous. And I think she's got a love interest in this film who's played very charmingly by Jason Isaacs. And you know, there's a real feeling in it of like, yes, it's about the dress, but it's also about how simply feeling that she deserves the dress really like kind of brings something wonderful out of this woman. I often find these kind of slightly, I suppose, grey pound feel good films a bit grating, but I think Leslie Manville is so charming.
Here's a question for you. Like, I haven't seen it yet. I'm really looking forward to it. But Leslie Manville, is she going to be nominated? Because I know when this film first premiered, I read a bit of buzz about her because obviously she was brilliant in Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, which I know did a lot of research for her for this film. She's talked about that period, fashion, etc. But there was talk about she's going to be Oscar nominated for this one. Do you think she will be?
I think she'd be BAFTA, not Oscar, because it is a very specifically British performance. She's playing this Cockney woman who is just so lovely and she helps out her clients that she goes and cleans the house for and sort of turns a blind eye to the things they do. And she's just got a heart of absolute gold. But she has spent her whole life putting others before herself. And, you know, like Layla said, this is a moment for her to actually say, no, I'm going to do something for myself. And within that, that unlocks the potential for her to actually do other things for herself, like seek out love, actually tell people that her abusing her time to stuff themselves. It's this magical thing, this dress. It's a genie in a bottle that allows her to fulfill her life. And yeah, I think it's something that BAFTA will really like, but I don't know that it would go all the way to Hollywood.
Yeah, it's just a lovely little film. I felt very similarly about it than I did, you know, The Duke that came out.
Yes.
And Duke was coming out for like years and years, wasn't it? But like, yeah, Leslie Manville, Ada Harris and Jim Broadbent in The Duke were somehow kind of two sides of the same coin for me.
Yes. Lovely, lovely people that deserve happiness. And it's a pleasure to watch them get it.
Yeah. And if there's a little bit of class warfare in between, great.
Why not? Okay. So if you fancy Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, that is in a cinema from Friday. Okay, it's time to get weird now with this.
A promising first concert. A wonderful
fact.
Woo!
time to move on and continue our investigation into an array of interculinary disciplines.
Flatulence?
Yes.
So this is Flux Gourmet, and this is the new film by Peter Strickland, who is famous for Barbarian Sound Studio and also In Fabric and The Duke of Burgundy. So those are quite challenging films. Jamie, try to explain what this one's about.
Well, this one goes even beyond those for weirdness. It's one for Peter Strickland fans only. Don't come into this one. If you don't know his films, don't start with this one. So it's set in a big country house, which might be in England. It might be somewhere in Europe. I wasn't sure. I don't think you're meant to be sure. And it is about a woman called Jan Stevens, played by Gwendoline Christie, who she gives monthly residencies to collectives who are interested in sonic cooking or culinary and alimentary performance. So what they do is they turn up for their month and they are making sounds from food. So they're putting microphones next to sizzling butter and in bubbling sauces and all of this and creating a kind of sonic soundscape. Well, it is obviously a soundscape if it's sonic. And they are also performing. So each evening they do kind of performances where they're miming and they're pretending to be grocery shopping while Gwendoline Christie is kind of telling them what they're doing. So she's saying, okay, and now you're over there and you're picking up a jar of jam, and they mime it all out. It's all very weird. And then they also do after dinner talking where they kind of share experiences from their past, like Arthur Butterfield, who's in it. He tells this fantastic story about his kind of fetish for this egg lady who, when he was younger, he used to queue up to get omelets. And it was this kind of middle-aged woman, the same age as his mother, who was very curvaceous. And he used to kind of talk to her. And it kind of, it's this almost like psychosexual trauma in a way. And he used to imagine her squatting over his face and laying an egg. So it's all very, very bizarre. And then if people do a performance in the evening or tell a good story and it goes down really well, then they are rewarded by everyone has an orgy, or that's how it seems. It may be all sort of dreamscape. I don't know. It's a very weird film. And that's it, really. There's another collective outside the building who got denied residency, who are trying to take revenge. So they're doing various terrorist attacks on the house, chucking things through the windows. And it's all leading up to a big performance at the end of the film. And that's it. I hope you can make head or tail of that. It's a weird one.
Yes. Did you like the weirdness?
I've got to be honest, Jane, I've seen this film twice because I saw it months and months ago and didn't really get on with it. I love Peter Strickland's work and I was quite disappointed by it. And I thought it was weirdness for weirdness sake. And then I watched it again yesterday for this podcast because I couldn't remember it much. And I got on with it a lot better. I liked it.
Is that because you were like engaged with the egg stories and like you were like weird factor had rubbed off? So if you watched it a second time, you could like really sort of wallow in that and sort of marinate in it?
No, I don't think so. I think I just got more out of it. The kind of weirdness parted a little bit for me and I saw more about, you know, that obviously it's about patrons and artists and kind of having to give up control because there's a battle between the director, Gwendoline Christie, and the woman who's the kind of head of the collective. So it's all about that. And it's about the patriarchy. And all these kind of themes became a little bit clearer to me. And I just appreciated the humour more this time, that I was chuckling all through it at the just madness of it and the idea of people doing colonoscopies as a performance in the evening and stuff like that. And I love the fact there's a guy who is like a journalist, an in-house journalist, and he writes about these collectives and what they're doing. And he provides the voiceover of the film. And I love the fact that he's giving this wonderful sort of Baroque voiceover, which is really a kind of thing of beauty in terms of the words he uses, how articulate he is, the way he delivers it. But he's mainly talking about his stomach problems, that he's got terrible flatulence.
Terrible.
So he's constantly talking about farting and stool samples and all of that. And there's maybe a bit much of that. It's not a film you want to watch with your tea, put it that way. But But I kind of found it funny and I really enjoyed it. Now, for Peter Strickland, those other films you mentioned of his, I think they're all superior. You get kind of more out of them. But I still found this, it's such a bizarre film. There's nothing else like it out there. And if you like kind of curios and, you know, just really weird, again, like he always does, it goes back to 70s sexploitation films and all of those things he's into. And it's very beautiful to look at. And the score is lovely and, you know, softly focused and all of that. And I got quite a lot out of it this time and I enjoyed it. But like I said, it is definitely one for Strickland fans. If you go in cold, you're going to just think, what the hell is this?
Layla, did you think, what the hell is this?
Yeah, I mean, I went into this sort of the opposite of The Greatest Beer Run, in that like this really should have been something for me because I really like Peter Strickland's, a lot of his other films. My best friend is a performance artist who tours the world doing generally stuff almost as weird as this. And like, I find that kind of pretentious art world stuff really fun. I used to work in food for years. So I was just like, yeah, surely this is going to be one for me. And it just, it didn't come together. I think there were moments where I kind of in my brain switched on that like, oh, this is a comedy, where then it would kind of click better. But I just never really like fell into a rhythm with it. I just thought it kind of seemed like purposefully strange in a way that covered up that there wasn't that much to say. Like, I think probably having seen David Cronenberg's Crime of the Future recently didn't help. I know a lot of people didn't love that film, but to me it kind of worked when you think of it in terms of like commentary on like performance art and, you know, spectacle and like what's an empty spectacle and what's a kind of like really sincere piece of artwork. But yeah, no, I was really disappointed. And there was a part of me when I was just like, okay, I'm just going to try and kind of look at this from the point of view of the comedy of like the, you know, making fun of these type of people, and just found myself wishing that I was watching like a Christopher Guest film, mockumentary style, because it kind of gets close to a mockumentary with the narrator journalist who I do think is excellent in the part. But yeah, it just kind of needed to pick a lane for me because it just seemed like didn't have much to say beyond like, oh, look how weird I'm capable of being.
Yeah, I'm not a Peter Strickland fan. I didn't like any of his other films. I didn't like this one. I don't think I have anything further to add to that. I'm not going to see it twice to see if it hits differently. But yeah, for me, I think if you're not into them, this is just where you're like, this is a make it end film. This is where you sit down like, oh God, is there another hour of this?
2 hours is ridiculous for this film.
It is. 2 hours is too long. Definitely too long.
And it just felt like, weirdness for weirdness sake. And like, ooh, look how weird and wacky I am. And if you don't like it or get it, then that's because you're not cool. So I'm not cool. I didn't love it. Well, there you go. If you fancy a bit of weirdness and you like Peter Strickland, then Flux Gourmet is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, final film now. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. It's this.
I have a gift for my favorite customers. Legend has it, it's on the 16th birthday that a witch gets her powers.
We have to get out of here. The witches will be here any second. Ah! The book is alive.
He woke up?
This is Hocus Pocus 2. Long gestated. We've been waiting for this for years. Worth the wait, Layla. Tell us what's going on in this one.
Well, it's been 29 years since the last Hocus Pocus film, which I found very upsetting to hear. So clearly it's this thing where Disney Plus are banking on basically the people that were children and enjoyed the first Hocus Pocus showing up to show their children Hocus Pocus too, and like tapping into their nostalgia. But the sort of gang is back together. We've got Bette Midler, Kathy Nanjami, and Sarah Jessica Parker, all back as the Sanderson sisters, a trio of witches who feast on children in order to keep themselves young and give themselves eternal life. In a similar fashion to the first film, they come back to Salem, where they were executed many years ago for being witches, and decide then they have until sunrise to either kill and feast upon a child. I'm not really sure. It doesn't really get back into
it's not that like, specific, is it?
It's not that specific.
Not that movie.
A kid will die at the very least, at the very least one, but also they want to kind of seek their revenge on Salem. There's really fun flashbacks at the beginning where we see kind of a trio of children playing the elder son and sister counterparts and, you know, kind of getting a bit into the like awful patriarchy that was Salem. And like, you know, I watched this with my daughter and in those scenes, she kept turning to me being just like, so who's the bad guy? And I was like, they're all bad guys.
All the guys are bad.
I was like, I'm sure someone good will appear. But yeah, we've kind of got a new generation of precocious teens, similar to the first one, that have to come and stop them from killing a load of children and seeking their revenge on the town of Salem.
Did it work for you 29 years later? Was it something that you had been waiting for?
It wasn't something I've really been waiting for, because why not just rewatch Hocus Pocus? I like Hocus Pocus very much. To me, you know, it was a bit like when you see a film that was great in a foreign language, something like Let the Right One In, and then you see the English language version and you just like, but why wouldn't I just, you got it right the first time. Mm-hmm. And this is just such a kind of repetition of a lot of the same jokes. And a lot, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think Bette Midler is fantastic in this role. I'd almost like, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker's great, I think, but it's a lot of the same jokes. Again, with a slight update. I mean, one of the funniest things I found so funny in the first one is a scene where they have to get brooms to ride, and one of them gets a broom and one of them gets a mop and the other one gets a Hoover, and like, yeah, the kind of extension cord keeps getting caught on things and stuff. And in this one, of course, then it's like somebody gets one of those Roomba vacuum cleaner, robotic vacuum cleaners. And I just like, oh, that's not any funnier. And it's the same joke. So whilst I didn't, you know, it wasn't miserable. I quite enjoyed like introducing my daughter to this world and, you know, that kind of, and I love that kind of kid horror, you know, that I enjoyed so much when I was younger. Yeah, I've been a bit of a people collecting a paycheck, I reckon.
Jamie.
Yeah, it didn't do it for me at all. I mean, it's a legacy sequel. Everyone's doing legacy sequels at the moment. And I could see why they did it in that, the first one obviously has its fans and people who adore it and will flock to this one. The first one I saw back in 1993 when it came out, I've never seen it since. So I'm not the audience for this. Like, you know, I haven't got that fondness, that tie to the original. But from what I can vaguely remember about it, I agree with Layla that it just seemed a bit of a rerun. But it's that same fish out of water thing that these witches from like the 17th century are suddenly in the modern age. And in this one, you got gags like Alexa, and obviously, you know, they think it's a woman trapped in a box talking, and it, you know, she must be all powerful and all of this. And it just felt a bit of a retread. The best thing about it for me was actually Billy Butcherson returns, who's the kind of zombie.
Yes, the good zombie. I'm a good zombie.
And he's played by Doug Jones, which I didn't realise, because Doug Jones, when he played it in 1993, was, you know, we didn't know who Doug Jones was. Now, of course, you know, he's played all of Guillermo del Toro's monsters, like he plays Amphibian Man in Shape of Water and Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth. And so he returns and he's just such a great physical actor, and there's real moments of kind of slapstick, all the usual stuff where he's losing it, he shakes someone's hand and his hand comes off and he's falling apart and all of that. But every time he appeared on the screen, I was kind of giggling. But I mean, you said earlier about, I don't know which film it was, but you said the moment this pod ends, I'll never think of it again. I feel like that with Hocus Pocus 2. I watched it and I kind of found it mildly diverting. I wasn't bored. I was watching it as I ate my tea, but the moment it finished, that's it. Never again.
I agree with you guys. You know, it passed the time. It was perfectly nice, but it wasn't Maverick, and it wasn't Ghostbusters Afterlife. It wasn't that, you know, legacy reinvention doing something clever for me. So I didn't see the point of it. And I too will probably never think of it again once we've finished chatting. However, it is on Disney Plus, so it's there for anyone to see and enjoy. And, you know, the kids will probably watch it on repeat, won't they?
Yeah, I have to say, it is quite nice to see a legacy remake that isn't about intergenerational trauma.
Yes, it is just about being an evil witch, which, you know, I can dig that. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Hocus Pocus 2, it is on Disney Plus from Friday. Film of the week, Layla.
It's going to be Blonde for me. I think that is generally like the most exciting and impressive feat this week. I think, you know, when I saw it a few weeks ago, I came out of it being like, oh, I really like that. I think it's going to be 50-50. So I'm not surprised to hear that so many people have taken against it. But yeah, I found it like a really impressive piece of work. And I think the number of people online that are telling me that makes me a terrible person can sod off.
Fine. Jamie, film of the week.
You're going to hate me for this, Jane, but I'm going to go Flux Gourmet.
Come on. What?
I am. By honestly, I enjoyed Blonde, I enjoyed Flux Gourmet, and I enjoyed The Greatest Beer Run Ever. There's not a lot between any of them for me, but if I had to pick one, which I do, Flux Gourmet just about nicks it.
Oh, go and stick your head in a pot of bubbling stew whilst you play a nose flute.
Sorry, I knew you'd hate me for that.
My film of the week is Blonde, so there.
Well, Blonde wins then, doesn't it? 2-1.
Yes, yes. So you can go off and do whatever it is you're going to do in your country house and enjoy your orgy.
I'm going to have an orgy and listen to butter sizzling. That's what I'm going to do.
Marvellous. As it's nearly Halloween month, very, very close, we should remind you that our Halloween Ends issue is on sale now with Laurie on the front with a big knife. Please do go and buy that. And we have time for a listener's question, which is prompted by the Blonde discourse. If you only watch one Marilyn Monroe film, which one should it be? Jamie.
For me, there is absolutely no doubt it is Some Like It Hot, Billy Wilder, 1959. I think she is absolutely luminous in it. I know there's always talk about her being a bad actress and needing 500 takes and blah, 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 blah. I don't care about any of it. She is a film star. She is wonderful. Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, great. Funny as hell. Still feels really fresh. Clips along at a great pace. Just great, great fun. One of Billy Wilder's best films. Some Like It Hot.
Layla.
My kind of favourite performance of her is Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I just think she's absolutely incredible in that. And she just has such a screen presence that even recently I rewatched All About Eve. And she's got a very small part in that, but it's honestly like an angel enters the screen. How radiant and incredible
in her gold dress.
Absolutely wonderful. But if I was going to say, because those things are so in the public consciousness, I was going to say, if you're going to watch something that maybe subverts your expectations of Marilyn Monroe, Niagara's great.
Oh, I love
Niagara.
And
like, she's so good in like the film noir role. Like, and I wish that we had gotten more kind of film noir out of Marilyn because she's fantastic in it.
Yeah, the femme fatale in the pink dress. She's amazing. And the lipstick on that is like, I don't even know how they've created that lipstick. It's amazing. She's brilliant in that. My choice would probably be, again, for sort of, if you think Marilyn Monroe is all about the shimmying and the sort of purring to camera, and which she is a lot of that. She's fabulous. I love both of your choices deeply, but I really love The Misfits. There's such a melancholy to it. And it's also just so interesting to read the backstory of that it was sort of written for her and then the weird role that he wrote for her and that she then had to turn up on set and play with a man who she often fantasized about being her father, Clark Gable. The whole thing is fascinating. And it's, you know, these horses that she's saying, don't capture these horses. And it feels very much like it's her saying it about herself, like stop trying to corral wild things and hurt them. Let them be. So yeah, that would be my choice, The Misfits. So we're out. We're done. It's time to say goodbye. Bye. So say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye, Jamie.
Say goodbye, Layla.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you next week.